Gentlemen, sorry to bother you. Which is the Kyle train?
That one just over there.
Grant, okay, thank you very much. Cheers, thank you. This is Inverness Railway Station. Effectively, this is the portal, the starting point for an adventure we're taking on this edition of Out of Doors.
Yeah, we're going to Kyle. How exciting is that? 80-odd miles away. One of the iconic rail journeys in Scotland. I've never done it.
No, neither have I.
And hugely up there on the tick list. And we're just going to have such an adventure on the way.
Well, essentially, it is 82 miles all the way from the North Sea to the Atlantic. It goes through, I mean, quintessential Scotland. You're talking about sea locks, freshwater locks, mountains, really pretty villages and things like that. So I should be cracking.
The man with the whistle's getting excited. We better get on the train.
When the sun has gone down on the dark western islands, our work, it's all done for a while. Well, we'll gather together, whatever the weather, and drive to the dancing in Kyle. Well, there's
really beautiful, Connerbridge, Dingwall, Garth, Athashine, Strathcadden, Strathpenny, Clopton, and Kyle of Lochouse.
We're driving through Dorney, Glenelgan, Kilillan, we're laughing as we race along.
Bumwark's the Lindsay McElraith. We're just crossing the River Ness now and heading for the Caledonian Canal.
Two grown men, grinning like schoolboys, hanging out the window, looking in the back streets of Inverness. He said, we're just going over the River Ness.
Yeah.
We're going up to the canal. And I've spent many a time sitting on a boat waiting for this very train to go over the Swine Bridge, which is a piece of, presume it's Victorian, engineering at its best. It's lovely.
It's no accident this is one of the most scenic routes in Scotland, because that is really why it was built. It was built to try and sort of regenerate the economy in the Highlands. As David Spavin, co-author of The Insider Rail Guide to Inverness, and Kyle McAlsh explains.
The traditional way of getting around the Highlands was, of course, typically around the coastline. That was far easier than going overland. But you also found drove roads which enabled farmers and crofters to take their cattle southwards to the big markets like the tryst at Falkirk. And then, of course, in parts of the Highlands, you ultimately had the military roads after the 1745 Jacobite Rebellion. But the area suffered from difficult transport, lots of mountains, being a long way from the centres of population. And that's, of course, where the railway transformed things. It was the wider effects, both economically and socially, that I think were the most striking. And the railways, particularly in the Highlands and the West Highlands, very quickly became targets for tourist traffic. And the railways produced guidebooks, they produced maps, they had day tours that encouraged people to get the train and then perhaps link to a horse-drawn bus, eventually a coach, and to steamers as well. So railways were absolutely the heart of the development of tourism in the West Highlands.
Tickets, please. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, no problem.
We'll hear more from David throughout the programme. There's still a lot of mist kicking about, so the sun's coming in low underneath it. Look across there at those gorse bushes. They're absolutely covered in spiders' webs. You get a sort of ghostly silver effect.
We're just coming into Dingwall, I think. There's a mart up on the left.
Uh-huh.
And from memory, Dingwall was hugely important for the railway, because of the amount of cattle that came here. We all sort of came from all over the Highlands, even from the Western Isles, to Dingwall before they started heading south. And we're still sharing the Wick line, is that right?
I think it kind of splits thereafter. We head off. But Dingwall's one of those places in Scotland. You look at the architecture and you think, there was a lot of money here. Once again, when they built these houses, this was a prosperous and wealthy place.
You can see it. It's rich farmland. We're kind of slowing down a bit now.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, beautiful buildings.
Yeah. If you look up, there's blue sky.
We are now approaching Dingwall.
Fair dues. Well, this is going to be our first stop because, as we're saying, this place has played a key role in the history of this train line, and you can find evidence of that at the station, where we're off to meet Jonathan McCall of the Dingwall Museum. This railway station was used as a tea stall for sailors and soldiers from the 20th of September 1915 until the 12th of April 1919, in connection with the Ross and Cromarty County Branch Red Cross Society, during which period 134,864 men were supplied with tea.
See, that's wonderful. How appalling that somebody actually kept count.
I wondered that too. It was Mina McKenzie who was the pusher for this. Mm-hmm. She was Miss Mina McKenzie, very much a driving force. You will get them in every town, mm-hmm. in every age. There is someone who is a member of every committee. I don't know why she was driven to do this.
But why were so many soldiers and sailors coming through Dingwall anyway?
You must have heard of the Jellicoe Express. The other plaque there...
Tell us about the Jellicoe Express.
Admiral Jellicoe was in charge of the Grand Fleet at the beginning of the First World War, which was stationed in Scapa Flow. The Jellicoe Express was a major line that was set up to bring in sailors from all over the country via London onto a line that came all the way up to here, onto the Highland Railway, further on past Dingwall, all the way to Thurso, so that they could get the boat at Scrabster to get onto Orkney. And you also had people going the other direction who'd be coming off the base on leave, or people in Dingwall who would be joining up, and they would be going south. I've got a photograph that won't work all that well on the radio, perhaps, but it's interesting looking at it to look at the quiet little station that we have now, mm-hmm. to compare it with what it might have been when the 4th Seaforths went to war. Yeah. Now, you can see off to the
left. There's so
many
tracks.
Yep. That pointy bit there is at the end of the platform we're standing on, mm-hmm. going up to our left. And off to the left of it are the multiple lines, including the Strathpeffer line, which was a short-lived one, but 1880s to 1940s isn't too bad.
But yeah, we're going to visit that later on the journey. But they've all got their rifles and their kilts.
Oh, this is the fourth. That's the 4th Seaforth in training.
That's it. Heading off the front, August 1914.
Yes.
Absolutely no idea what was in front of them.
No idea. We've got a memorial outside that they set up after the Battle of Cambrai in 1917, and there's about 40 names on it, just from that set of Dingwall.
We're going to Kyle today. I mean, was Dingwall an important part on that line?
Oh, yes. This area supplied Aberdeen, Edinburgh, London with food. An awful lot of grain, a huge amount of meat. There was a huge sheep tryst at Lairg, some miles north of here. Dingwall itself had a reasonable-sized tryst and auction room. The next big tryst was down at Muir Vord, on the way to Falkirk or Creef, and further south. So through this area came the fish wagons from Kyle, huge numbers of cattle and sheep from the north and the west, heading down the way to be picked up at auction rooms, different dealers buying different groups. In the 1880s, the fish coming in from the west, again, were coming in huge quantities.
As a historian, do you get frustrated that the backstories behind this are so rich, they're so varied, and people, there's no way of telling, you know, and unless they do the type of research or, you know, there's nothing to show here what the history of this place was.
Well, let's move out a bit. Let's just move out a bit onto the line and have a look. Do you notice how wide the platform is that we've just walked? Does that strike you as odd? How many other train platforms, and I'm talking Waverley and Perth, mm-hmm. how many other platforms are this wide?
You would expect it to end sort of here.
Yeah. You would. Well, do you see that small grey building? That replaces the 1862 station house. That was where it started. And that stayed there until the 1880s when the Highland Rail decided to build a grander one, which they did. But the local council, the borough council, said, don't do it by knocking down the old and build the new. Build the new one back a bit so that the old one can carry on in use for other purposes. And that they did. And if they hadn't, we wouldn't have had the space to serve 134,000 cups of tea.
we wouldn't have had the space to entrain whole regiments here. All because of someone in the 1880s thinking, let's do it nicer.
Jonathan McCall of the Dingwall Museum there. Jonathan gave us this photograph.
Well, it's a copy of a photograph.
But it's dated August 1914. It's the 4th Seaforth Highlanders embarking for the front. That's interesting in and of itself. But what fascinated me was this. Because essentially on this side of us, you know, to my right, because I'm facing, you know, my back's the direction of travel, I counted 5 sets of railway lines there. I mean, this was a huge terminus thing.
Yeah.
And then 1, 2, 3, 4
yeah.
on the other side.
Yeah.
Absolutely massive. You know, it's kind of, I suppose,
the dwarfs what exists now, isn't it?
Gateway to the Highlands. It's, yeah. it's hard to believe, looking at this single track from this moment, that that was so big.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dingwall was a key station for lots of reasons, but not that terribly far away there is another town which should have been on the line and actually wasn't on the line. The local landowner didn't like the idea of it.
He wasn't very keen.
Wasn't very keen on it. You know, Strathpeffer.
You can see the, sorry, I'm just interrupting you.
All right, go
you
on.
Can look down the Firth and the line to Wick is just peeling off. So we're on the proper bit now. We're on the dedicated line to Kyle and Gulch. This is lovely. You just feel it's going to get more scenic. It's going to get more impressive.
Which it will.
We leave the farmland, we leave the Firth, and we head off into the Highlands with a wee detour takes some water.
Strathpeffer had a reputation as a spa town, you know, water that was supposedly had curative properties, etc. No. Do your powder good. But landowner didn't like the idea of having a railway running past his lands. He said, no, not getting permission at all. So if you wanted to get to Strathpeffer, you had to get off at Achternead, I think it was, and then get a coach and horses up to Strathpeffer. And eventually a branch line was built, which was really key to the popularity of the place, because it was extremely popular at one time.
Accommodation for the better class of visitors is difficult to be obtained in the immediate vicinity of the springs, but many persons find it agreeable to reside in Dingwall and walk or ride to the pump room every morning. In this way, we accounted for the groups of idle dandies and flaunting belles sauntering about the streets, evidently without any other object in view than that of exhibiting their bright tartans and fancy bonnets.
I wish I'd worn mine now.
My name is Arthur Scott. I live in the centre of Strathpeffer here. It was a thriving place long before the railway came, even before Inverness, because Inverness was served before the railway came by steamers, and they would have 4 or 5 steamers in every week from places further south and the continent as well. And these folks would then make their way here by stagecoach normally, or by carriage. And if they got as far as Dingwall, then they would maybe even think about walking.
So what's this building? Because you've got the big pavilion-y thing, which is lovely Victorian glass and pillars, and this seemingly older structure, very much solid sandstone, very much smaller.
You mean this building that was described as a shed?
Well,
is that the one?
That's
by
the very
whom?
Beast.
Right, by the people that frequented it. This is much grander than the original building that was here, which literally was a big hut.
Mm-hmm.
This was probably put up, or certainly extended in its present form, in the early 1900s, when a London syndicate took over the running of the spa. This is the last remaining building of the pump room buildings as such, and it's referred to as the upper pump room because it's further up the road than the lower pump room, which is lower down the road.
Go inside and have a shifty.
Around about 1862, there was a complaint from the poor people about the upper pump room because they introduced a charge of 18 pence a week. Now, that allowed them not just to get the waters, but it allowed them facilities like croquet and all the other things that they probably didn't want. A bit like an American resort tax nowadays, if you like. But this verse was found on the wall of the original pump room. It reads, "Come in, ye sick, and rest yourselves, if rest or health ye seek. The waters here are free to all. for 18 pence a week.
There's a board here, Arthur, that essentially says sulphur wells to these taps. One, so tap one is the old well, tap two is the Sutherland well, tap three the Morrison's well, Cromarty well, and the fifth tap is from the Iron well.
Right, so each tap comes from a different place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different tanks. They had big storage tanks. In the lower pump room, before this place was built, they didn't even have a pump, and no one really knows why it was called a pump room. And someone would have, if you wanted water, someone would have to go down some steps, scrape away the sulphur scum that was on it, get a bucket and take it up to you. And at the very beginning, what people used to rush for it because it was the rich sulphur crust that was on it that attracted people.
But the skin in a rice pudding, I want the skin.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So would you take different well taps for different conditions?
Yes.
So you have a cocktail?
The doctor that you consulted would write out a prescription for you, and he would not only write out the actual amount of water and how the frequency of it, but he would build in some kind of fitness regime as well, which included maybe a two-hour walk or a game of croquet or whatever it was. So that was all kind of the holistic kind of approach to it.
They still do that in certain countries in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their national health services will suggest that you go to a particular spa for a particular period of time for a particular amount of water.
There was a big movement after the First War and a smaller movement, I suppose, after the Second War to resurrect the spa treatment mm-hmm. in Strathpeffer on the National Health Service. It came to nothing, I'm afraid.
Was there any indication if these cures worked, or was it part of actually you're in a very relaxing atmosphere, you might be doing a walk, you might be doing more exercise than you would normally have done?
Drinking more water than port.
I think the regime certainly helped. I think originally the people who came here genuinely came here because they thought it would do them good. And they believed in that. And they would maybe come for 4 or 6 weeks at a time. The poorer people who used to come here, they were quite heavily segregated. They couldn't stay as long without some kind of subsidy from charity, if you like. And then I think the spa got hijacked. It got hijacked by gentry. It became gentrified, where people would come for the cure, not necessarily to make themselves better medically, but to just relax and get rid of the stresses of day-to-day life.
Did the poor people still get access to the water, though?
They did. They got access to the water here.
Okay.
So this is the poor man's
house? This was the poor man's
house. That's why I'm feeling so comfortable
house.
Here.
Yes.
There's a reconstruction here. There was a man and a woman and a lady who's actually serving them water with an invalid chair across the other side.
Yes. Before they employed people to give the water out to prescription, in days gone past, somebody would be sitting, an old woman might be sitting down at the well here in the square with no shelter, and she would dish out the water to people, and some people would give her a penny, and some people would give her thanks.
See, given the long history of this place, given how beautiful the buildings are and how beautiful the village is itself, it is a real shame that it's not still on the go, that it hasn't been sort of rejuvenated, got back on its feet again.
Well, I think it has. Not necessarily to do with the spa waters, but the village has reinvented itself, certainly over the last 30 years. And pretty much everything in the village has been renewed or built.
Any plans to reinstate the waters?
Not to my knowledge.
Or bottle the waters?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Seems like an opportunity going ahead.
I can't see it, I'm afraid. There's too much competition from the likes of Buxton and, you know, all these other places.
Yeah, but they don't have sulphur to scrape off at all.
So exactly. I mean, you drink their water, whereas you could kind of rub it in the top of your head, yeah.
I've tried that. It doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
Arthur Scott there in Strathpeffer. You're listening to Death of the Wars on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith.
And today we are on one of the great iconic railway journeys of Scotland, Inverness to Kyler Le Halche. As you leave Dingwall, you're starting up more or less from sea level, and then you climb up to about, I think the highest point's about 450 feet on this line. But the train is now coasting. Prior to this, it's been puffing and trying to get us. Well, not, it's a diesel, but you know what I mean. You know, you've got a real sense of effort of the train coming up. Yep. This, on my right-hand side, on your left, I think is Raven Rock.
What the great sights.
It's about 250 feet high. There's this huge cliff that heads off.
A real cleft in the rock at the moment. We must have to blast our way through this.
In David Spavin's book, it actually says here,
culminates at Raven's Rock Summit, second highest summit of the journey at 451 feet. Used to require a banking engine to get them up, so that an engine at the front and an engine at the back. But this, the Raven's Rock, they shifted something like 20,000 cubic yards of rock to put the railway line through. And that's explosives at wheelbarrows. Something satisfying, but the road goes parallel to the train at the moment, and there's a tanker lorry matching us for speed as we slow down, coming up to Garve.
Yeah.
And this is where road meets rail at the level crossing.
Yeah. Garve is where we used to get off here and actually pick up on the bus to go to Elbow.
We are now approaching Garve.
Thank you very much. To get the bus up to the mail, the newspapers, all that kind of stuff used to go here. But
there's no rail up across the...
No, not up to that area. But there was a plan there. If you get to Garve, and again, this is from David Swaven's book. I'd spotted this before, but I didn't know what the logic of it was. There's a really wide...
We're in it just now. There's a passing loop. There's another section of rail just suddenly appeared.
But it's very wide.
Which we are parallel to, but yeah, very wide.
Well, the logic of this was that they want to transport fishing boats from the east coast to the west coast, or vice versa, I can't remember which, but they needed 16 feet wide on either side.
For a fishing boat?
Well, just in case two fishing boats passed one another. It never took off.
It's a good idea. I mean, the Calderon Canal ticks that box of taking herring boats from the east to the west and vice versa. Lovely wee station. Courageous use of yellow on the station house.
Slightly mad. That's the original station building.
This is Garve. This train is for Pelham
O'Halsh. Very, very bright yellow. Line of scenic magnificence. This next station, Loch Lucat, which they closed and then moved somewhere else because I think they raised the level of the loch. It doesn't have a reputation of being particularly bonny.
Yeah, it was for a hydro scheme. They thought it should have raised it by 25 feet or something like that. So somewhere down there, I don't know if they moved it or just...
There's a pretty station under the water.
At the bottom of it as well.
Great. Well, attractive or unattractive Loch Lucat station is, we're going to get off here because the lady lives here called Manager Hal. She grew up in Coventry, a very interesting background because she absolutely loves this area, loves the outdoors.
I've always loved the Northwest Highlands. The only way I can describe my relationship with mountains and mountain landscapes is it's much bigger than me. I genuinely mean that. You know, a lot of people can say that, but I am in love with this landscape. I've been all over the world and I've seen some magical places. You know, I've been doing that for a living, but I also do it because I'm driven by it. I long to come back because I feel that everything I want is right here, and I miss being here. I'm an Indian girl that grew up in Coventry. 12 years I've been here now. Our dad, every weekend, took us camping into the outdoors, even though we grew up in Coventry. And if it was a good day in Coventry, we would be sleeping out in the gardens. And the neighbours twitching, going, oh, God, that stupid family, there they go again. There they are. They've all gone out. And it was like the whole family would, you know, would just take our duvets out and sleep, not sleeping bags and stuff, you know, just sleep out on the lawn in the garden. So it wasn't something new as much as it was, it's going to be a very integral part of my life.
But that was as a child. So presumably they thought once you hit maturity and what have you would leave the childish things behind you and you'd behave sensibly.
No, it wasn't a child. It was 16 when I got introduced to the mountains, when this wow, you know, what we do now.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, because you carried on past 16, you thought, hang on a second, no, we didn't intend this.
No. So I suppose the question you're asking is, how did my parents accept it, or why was it different? So why was it different is the traditional way, particularly first generation, Asian communities, immigrant communities from the Asian Indian background, is that you're expected to go into a career that will make money. and a respectable career, and most certainly being in the outdoors is, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
When we were just left India to get away from all that, you know, the basics of life, and come here and, you know, get a nice fancy house with all central heat and the mod cons and all that stuff, and, you know, get married, you know, in the traditional way, have children and everything else.
So you turn up here on the edge of the loch, in your house, on your own.
I'm going to start winding forward a wee bit to my postie, who took about 2 years, 3 years. I love my postie. And he sat me down. He's not here with us anymore, unfortunately. He sat me down. Well, he knocked on the door and gave me a post. And then he plucked up the courage, because I didn't realise that he was in pain, and I gave him some stuff for his knees. And he goes, what are you doing here? What are you doing? What made you come and move out here to Loch Lucat? Well, all the places that you could choose from in the world, why come to Loch Lucat? And I said, because I'm a drug dealer. and he should have seen his face. And he obviously thought I was serious. I'm like, sit down, will you? Just sit down and have a cup of tea with me. And I explained the thing about, you know, I'm a mountaineer, I'm a climber, I ride bikes, I love exploring wild places. And that is the thing that brought me here. And I still, to this day, the view that you're looking out the front, just this morning I took a photograph, you know, and I'm constantly sharing it. And the fellas that are now decorating the house, you know, they were like, they're taking photographs. And it's where I need to be. I found my spiritual home.
How do you use the landscape around a bit? I mean, your own personal use. Do you use the train to get places?
Oh, absolutely. For my first year, you know, I was telling you that I did a fair amount of corporate world all over the world. And so I lead treks. So I had a backpack and I had a suitcase. I got the train at Loch Lucat to get to Inverness to get the bus to the airport. The train fella goes, you're going far? And I says, yeah, I'm going to Hong Kong, then I'm going to go to Nepal, and then I'm coming back, you know. He goes, oh, so you'll be changing in Inverness then? which is brilliant. And he put me in my place and I thought, I've landed. Nobody gives a toss about what I do. It's fantastic. So it was so refreshing. And, I love the train here. I have friends that come and visit regularly, and they get the train because it's quite cheap and cheerful. But I also use it. I get on the bike right here and I can cycle out to Strathcarron and have a pint and then come back home. I send folks off and get them to get off at Achnashellach, and then there's a lovely Corrie Lair. You could do some beautiful walks around there.
Mm-hmm. Can you take bikes on them?
Yeah, really. And they're really friendly, particularly with short distances. And I've never had an issue with the bikes on the train here. And I love it. And it's also my alarm call. 7:45 train is my alarm call in the morning. I know then it's 7:45. For those of us that can sleep until 7:45.
There aren't many.
Yes.
But it's such a fantastic playground here, just in terms of getting into the hills, the water. It all meshes together so beautifully here.
Yeah. And if I can give you an example of, I had my 19-year-old nephew, Taron, and his three friends, his uni friends, and they came for 4 days, and they wanted to be broken. And they arrived on an overnight bus, and then I picked them up. As soon as they arrived here, we scooted over the railway line, dropped down to the loch, went swimming in the loch immediately, and then the next day we could have got the train to Achnasheen, and then they went up and did a hill, and then they came back, and then we went off and did a mountain bike ride, and then we went for a run, and then they sat under a waterfall, and then I put them back on the night bus, you know. So there's lots and lots of things to do.
Do you know how inadequate we now feel?
I want you two to come and join us, honestly, but it was brilliant. They were just my family. They've changed what they do in the outdoors, by the way, down in Coventry as a result of being up here. And, you know, some of the comments, one of my young lads said, they'd just gone off to Disneyland or whatever, and he goes, oh, that wasn't my best holiday. My best holidays ever is coming up to Pammy's at Loch Lucat.
It's a funny old squeak.
It's not me. I thought it was maybe my knees for a minute, but it's not. We're actually more or less halfway on this trip. It's open landscape, hills on either side. The cloud is lifting, there are patches of blue sky. We're on something of an adventure today, but we're approaching Achnasheen.
A as I understand it, Achnashin means field of the rain. And as we warn people in our guide, the sun does not always shine on the way from Inverness to Kyle of Lochalsh. It's a place where the trains traditionally used to cross, and passengers could nip off the train and had up to 10 minutes to have a swift dram in the bar of the hotel right beside the station. And sometimes you would even have the driver and the guard having a dram as well. Such things do not happen anymore, in part, of course, because the hotel burnt down in 1995, but also railway staff do not go anywhere near alcohol these days.
We are now approaching
a fishing object. No drams for us, sadly.
No, we were literally on the wagon. This is Out of Doors of BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. We're on a train chugging our way towards Kyle of Lochalsh. This is we're currently motoring towards the Luab Summit. And that's the watershed as well. Basically, the water changes direction.
Well, you can see it. You can see on the horizon there's nothing. Yes. We're going to be dropping down. And there's a kelpie that lives in one of these lochs just along here.
I'm not sure of the pronunciation. I think it's Loch Scaven, but a nasty kelpie grabbed hold of people, dragged them under the water, ate them, and then the only bit it didn't eat was the lungs, which would come popping to the surface. Why is that?
I've never understood that about kelpies. They are strange, strange things. There's a wee cottage here. Look at this walkway going to one of the lochs. Raise it above the bog, and you got a lonely, twisted oak tree there. It's been battered by the elements, and nothing else around it. And that icy blue, it's almost gunmetal blue of the loch at the moment, just because of the way the sun's hitting it.
I love these wee wooded islands, in the middle of these lochs.
It just shows you the power of deer. Yeah. The fact that the red deer aren't getting out there. Yeah. And on these wee tiny islands, there is massive natural woodland.
Well, I don't know about you, but I could actually do getting off the train temporarily and just stretching my legs. It's a bit, not cramped is the wrong word, but
it's tight.
It's too nice. Tight.
It's a beautiful day.
Yeah.
We're not in a hurry.
No, exactly. So, Achnashowach's coming up. There is supposedly a route up the back of that. Well, we don't have time to do it. If you went far enough, you'd get as far as Torridon. But, holiday, take advantage.
Now approaching Achnashowach. This is a request stop.
It doesn't even look like a railway station. Essentially, this is Achnashowach. There is a platform of sorts. This is one of the request stops. But it's bang smack in the middle of trees. There's Roseby Willow Herb that's gone off. We're just absolutely surrounded by birch trees, sycamore trees, ash, hawthorn. Stuff that's changing colour up there. You can see the hills above the trees, and the tops of the hills are actually in mist. But there's a sign here that says, Scottish Rites Away Society, for Coolin Pass and Corrie Lair, go straight ahead and up the path. Do not walk along the railway. So 9 miles that way, you're in Torridon.
Fantastic. You're the one thing. There's no houses, no people. Why is it here?
Yeah, good question. Good question. It must have been for the local estate, shooting parties, something of the kind. There's a house along there. You can see the chimney kicking out through the trees.
Presumably that was a railway house.
Yeah. Well, let's go through. Could have been.
But it seems to be a feature of this whole line. There's just halts in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. There is. I mean, if that is a waiting room, it's the small. It's about the waiting room about the size of a toilet. You can wait, but you have to stand up. We've not long had weeks of rain, and there's water all around us. There's burns and waterfalls and boggy bits. But the sun's out, and all of a sudden, the scents, the perfume of the land, is just absolutely everywhere. You're getting the bracken going off, the last of the heather, and almost a sort of, almost a medicinal smell to it.
Yeah, and it's kind of odd, because it's really hot now.
Yeah.
But the mountains above us are almost a completely different climate. Swathed in clouds. Just hanging there. It's a fair old contrast from down below, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Isn't that beautiful? There's just one of the round trees, and it's still hanging with berries. but the leaves are sort of competing with the colour of the berries just in patches. So it's going from a really deep red through to peaches and yellows and things, oranges. But this bit here is almost like a sort of little hanging valley. It's lovely.
That's interesting. Why would they do that? Why would they leave a brush? Follow forest track for Achna Shellach.
It's... And a bit of what? Tell you?
Yes?
It's because of the tree disease.
Okay.
And they don't want to spread it from one part of the forest to the other. So you clean your boots with the said attached brush. Well, it's a sign of the times, it's on a bit of chain.
There you go. Phytophthora ramorum. For once, you actually got the answer without cheating and looking at the board.
You know what, I'm going to come clean on this.
There was another one. It's not a very high falls. At some stage, I think there must have been a catchment area for a hydro scheme or something of the kind, because there's a pipe leading off. So I think this is the head of dam, possibly for a hydro scheme further down. And it's old, I would say, but this is 1930s, something like that.
It's beautiful, isn't it? Clear water.
The water looks completely clear. It can't be, because the stones in the bottom are covered with a sort of moss, browny green colour. All the stones look slightly furry. It's bright green on top of the dam. There's a spillway through the centre of it, but it just goes up through these birch trees in a series of almost, you know, it's like steps going up the river. And behind that, you've got the mountains, and about, I don't know, 7-8 miles that way, Torridon.
Beautiful wee walk.
It's a shame we've got a train to catch. Grand place for a picnic, though.
Brilliant place for a picnic. Get some brown trout.
You could guddle them.
We could guddle them. A bit of a long wait.
Bonnie, bonnie part of the world, and you know, a great place to go for a wander, and I would really like to do the full 9 miles across the torrent at some stage.
Yeah, we're just pulling out of the Shellach now, and if you look down, it demonstrates the power of the landowners at that time, because way down there is the loch, and that was the original preferred route for the railway, but the owner of the land, Captain Tennis, said, no, I'm not having that, you have to go, and there was a big detour to go up the hill, big cost to everybody, and right round it, he didn't want it near him. But he got into it. It's actually, it's a quite a good thing.
I don't think I'm making my own train.
And just after it opens, well, I'll have a party. And he commissioned two special trains from Inverness, 200 guests. And the going rate, I think it was about 8 shillings a mile for a special train. He said, I'm not paying that. Offered him 4 shillings, and the board of directors said, yeah, okay, we'll do that. Had his party, huge success. Sent in the bill, and he said, oh, I'm not paying that. And they came down to 2 shillings a mile. Still wouldn't pay it. Came down to 1 shilling a mile. Still wouldn't pay it. And eventually, when they tried to enforce it, it sold up and left. So he never paid for his special trains. But it just shows how much clout these guys have.
It's a very fine old tradition of the landed gentry. Time after time, you get stories like that, essentially. We're heading down to Strathcarron now. The Strathcarron Hotel is right beside the platform. Also a key stop for getting off for different parts of the Highlands. Passengers were taken by stagecoach to Lough Carron and Shieldaig and Torridon, and I think the motor service started after the First World War. But I thought we could stop at Strathcarron for another reason, because although we have been spectacularly abstemious so far...
That's about to change.
In the pipe here, so we're just splashing through the water so beer comes through, and then that's beer then.
Hello.
Just judging by the smell of the yeast, this must be the place.
Yeah.
I'm Mark.
I'm Colin.
Nice to meet you, Colin. How are you doing?
Martin.
Hello there.
Martin.
Nice to meet you, Martin.
Hi.
How are you?
Paul.
Hello, Paul. How's things?
Hi.
We were in a band together for a long time. When we was making no money playing music. So we thought, another crazy idea. which was brewing beer. And Colin had been brewing beer for a long time, homebrew. And he came away with these amazing recipes. We're all retired, virtually semi-retired, you know, so it's a cleaning job with beer at the end of it, you know, so that's that's what it's like, you know. It's all cleaning and washing. And
you must be, what, 2 miles away from the station here?
2 miles from the station, exactly.
Basically, yeah. Up a single-track road.
Yeah.
You know, you go in, it's a flat river valley, uh-huh. Essentially. Hills on either side. There's a waterfall comes down behind.
Well, that's the exact water that makes the beer. It comes down from the hill there into the ground, comes up as a spring, and is fed through a UV filter system and directly into your fermenters as beer, really. That's it.
Oh, what was that you were actually just sticking in that vat across there?
Well, we're just getting ready to put the hops in.
So. Yeah. These are the flavouring hops. There were bittering hops going earlier in the process.
We've got a boil going on here already. That's brewing just now. You worry about me all the time.
Why do you think craft beers have taken off in Scotland? Because for decades, it was something you could get in England, but the Scots drank fizzy yellow stuff, which was mass-produced, and then suddenly out of nowhere, there's people like me going in, what local beer have you got?
Well, there's always been beer drunk in Scotland. It's just been slightly different from English beer, partly because of the water, but also partly because lager was imported from Germany to the Central Belt way before England got it. It was something like 70 years before England got lager, Scotland got it. I think it was Tennent's brought the first lot in, and then it took off, so they started brewing it themselves. English beer turned out a bit different from Scottish beer. But then, obviously, more recently, you get imports and exports and things more.
How far afield do you actually market this stuff?
About 35 miles is the limit.
Why 35?
Just because that's where the pubs we deal with happen to be.
Five different
hotels.
North is Torridon.
Yeah.
Plockton in the west.
So do you plan to expand?
No. Not really. We quite...
Take all the fun out of it.
That's right. We're quite like just what we're doing, you know. We just make enough to get 11. The three of us get 11 out of it. And
so it's moved really from a hobby into a business, but you're close enough to hobby to be comfortable.
Yeah.
You don't want to go
it's
multinational
crossing,
conglomerate.
It's diversification as well, which is it's my son that has a croft here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're just using the croft shed.
Uh-huh.
And he takes rent of us, you know. We basically sell as much as we can brew, and the rest goes into bottles, and we sell the bottles in shops and restaurants.
Uh-huh. I mean, we've opted to go for a middle of the road, just straightforward beer, just making it the best possible quality we can. Mm-hmm. And that really works for everybody, you know.
Can we try it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So that seems to be the next logical step.
Xanapur.
That's absolutely perfect, thank you.
Presumably this is the golden cake.
This is gold, yeah.
There's a fruity taste in it more. It's almost like apricot to me. How would you describe that?
Beery.
Well, that was refreshing. Our thanks to the boys at Strathcarran Brewery.
Yeah, beer for breakfast.
You're listening to a special edition of Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mar Stephen, he's Ewan McElroy. This morning we're on the Inverness to Kyle and LaCalf Railway. Just thoroughly enjoying this. I mean, the sun has come out, it's beautiful.
You start in Inverness with a smile, and it has just got bigger and bigger and bigger. It's not even a steam train.
No.
And the thing is, you know, the scenery's going to get better and better.
Well, this route was set up really for two reasons. One, sort of economic regeneration of the Highlands initially. But two, to try and build a tourist attraction, which you can understand why. Because it just gets more and more dramatic the further towards Kyle LaCalf you get. Arguably, some of the most scenic bits are still to come. Once upon a time, there were observation cars on this route to make the most of the views.
If you go back to Edwardian times, the Caledonian Railway introduced an observation car between Glasgow and Oban called the Maid of Morven, and this was the epitome of luxury at the time. Hooked onto the back of the train with panoramic windows, so you got a delightful view of the passing countryside. And eventually, in the mid-1950s, British Railways, as was, decided this was a good idea to reinvent the concept. And they began introducing observation cars on the West Highland lines and then to Kyle in 1961. And very popular. I remember travelling on them as a child, and a wonderful view, and you would get a description of the route from a well-informed railway conductor. And it was a great day out for tourists and indeed for locals who wanted a leisurely day looking at the scenery. Sadly, these observation cars were withdrawn in 1967, and British Rail claimed that they were life expired. There were four of them operating in the West Highlands, and all four of them are still operating on heritage railways down south. So it was a shocking bit of, sort of negative management in the immediately post-Dr. Beeching era. I would love to see observation cars running again in the Highlands. They do that sort of thing in Canada, the USA, Switzerland. But I'm afraid it's a long time since we've really properly dealt with the tourist market on rail in Scotland. There have been some improvements. The rolling stock that runs from Inverness to Kyle is being refurbished. The seats match the views from the window much better. There'll be more spaces for luggage. And there will be Visit Scotland tourist ambassadors travelling on selected trains telling people more about what they're seeing out of the window. But I think we really need to go for the big time in terms of proper observation cars. But I'm afraid I'm not holding my breath for that.
We are now approaching Atterdale. This is a request stop.
David Spavin, co-author of The Insider's Guide to the Inverness and Kyle MacAlsh Line. There are actually six request stops along this line, and we're about to come to one of them. Joanna McPherson is from Atterdale Gardens. How do these work? I mean, how do you go about organising your request stop?
Well, if you're on the train, you have to ask the conductor, and she comes around and looks at your ticket. They notice if you're going somewhere, it's a request stop, and then they write it down in their little book and tell the driver, so that works fine. And if you're looking for the train, you wait on the platform, and then they can see you waiting, and they let you get on.
Always
so
assuming it's not raining and you're hiding in the shed, in which case you miss the train.
You're dead right. You want to be careful to be out there.
Coming back from holiday.
Yes, it's amazing. It's very good. Sorry, it's really heavy.
I'll give you a hand off.
That's really sweet.
No
Thank
problem.
You so much.
There you go.
Thank you. It's really
there you
heavy.
Go.
Thank you so much.
We will come and see you shortly.
Okay, lovely. See you later.
Thank you.
We've walked, I don't know, 20 metres off the main drive of your house, and we've climbed up this little rocky escarpment. And there is the most fabulous view that way. Just describe it to me.
Well, you can see the Coolins from here, and those hills in the distance are up behind Broadford. But, I mean, that's about 25, 30 miles away. Mm. And you are lucky, because the sky is blue. So you're seeing right down Loch Arran, you're looking due west towards the Isle of Skye.
It's cracking, you've got the railway next door.
Indeed, and it's being used more and more by people because they can come from Kyle or they can come from Inverness. They can get off by request and just walk up. We've got a pedestrian gate there and you can just walk through.
There's something wonderfully romantic and charming about a little tiny halt beside a beautiful loch and then walking up to your own house. It's lovely.
It is lovely and it's a luxury and it's great fun because one of the things we do, my husband Alec, for example, when we've got people here in the summer or young volunteers working in the garden on a Friday, they catch the train from Atterdale station and in 5 minutes they're at the Strathcarran and they can go into the bar there, celebrate for an hour or two and then come back again. No one has to drive a car and it takes 5 minutes to get there and 5 minutes to get back.
In the foreground of the view we were talking about earlier is this spectacular garden. I mean, just beautiful. It's a sort of quintessentially Victorian or Edwardian Scottish garden. We came through big stands of gunnera, there are fuchsia, rhododendron, big mature trees and things. You know, where did this come from? Who started it?
I think it would probably be true to say it was started by the Schroders, who are a German banking family, and they started renting it when it became fashionable to have a place in the Highlands. They used to rent it from the Mattisons. This was Mattison country right up until the middle of the 19th century, and they obviously rented it to the bankers, and they were seriously into gardening. So there are some lovely photographs in the DIY tea room with Captain Schroeder supervising the planting of the rhododendrons, which were obviously very fashionable there. And all there's been big dramas here with storms and wind and things, but the amazing things about rhododendrons is they come back. So even if they're blown over, they kind of regenerate.
But you get a very good climate for doing what you're doing here, because it all looks green.
It looks very green, doesn't it? That's because we get over 80 inches of rain a year. It rains an awful lot. So the biggest challenge for gardening here is the water and getting the water away. Mm-hmm. And not only have you got the railway line blocking it, but you've also got the road now. My mother started getting involved 35 years ago when all of the trees behind us on this steep slope were blown down and they had to clear fell the whole thing and replant it with trees. So it's actually grown very well. We've got something called the Gulf Stream that comes up the west, so although we're probably almost on the same latitude as Moscow, look at it. I mean, even in winter, if we do have frost and snow, it doesn't stay very long.
Did your mother take that kind of thing on the chin, or do you sit in the corner and my garden's gone?
I think she was a bit sad, but also I think it was to stay sane, married to my father and staying up here, so he was away earning a living from time to time, and she was a painter by origin, an artist, so she sees things very visually. And she's a driven woman, so she drives us all on even now, even though she's in her mid-80s. She still has a vision about what should be happening here.
If you look at the plants around about here, I mean, you know, they're from mountainous areas, from places like Nepal, China. They fit here. I mean, you come back, you might. We drove past a stand of bamboo there, and it just works.
My mother would say it's about looking through as an artist. Yes. You're looking through to the next place. So we're standing here and we can see through to the sunken garden and beyond where the tall cypresses are. And wherever you go here, if you explore and wander about, you can look through to different places and see other places to go and explore. So it encourages you to go on looking through. To the giant sundial. If my father was leading this tour, he would say that this is a drug-fueled inspiration because that used to be their bedroom up there, and she was on steroids at the time because she's got various health issues. So she had this brilliant idea.
Is it a wildcat?
Yes, it's the heraldic crest for the Macphersons. It's a wildcat. So that's called a gnomon, and that shows you the time. And if the sun was out, if the sun came out from behind the clouds, you could see what the time was. And there's a lot of endless discussion over there, and there's a tablet, because we're 20 minutes west of Greenwich Mean Time.
Yeah.
So you then work out what the time is
from that.
And the
gnomon itself is carved out of a piece of slate.
This has been carved out of a piece of slate by a lady called Gabriella Ainsworth.
Yeah. And it's a lovely piece of work, but I mean, right the way across, it's probably, 10, 12 feet in diameter?
Yes, and the idea was this saved you having another bed to plant every summer, but of course it's not strictly true. Yeah, in theory, it's saving on work. And then you've got a thistle here for my dad, who's Ewan. He's a Ewan Macpherson. And my mother came from South Africa, so there's a protea for her. Uh-huh. And if he was here, he'd say that when they pop their clogs, they want their dates to be put on underneath their initials.
Oh, that's nice.
And over there's a bench, and Gabriella Ainsworth made them both sit in some cement, so you've got a very large bottom.
We've got bottoms.
Look at the bottoms. Dad's quite, he's 6'3", or was. Uh-huh. So he was wearing corduroys, I think. And then mother's not so, is littler than him and not so well, so they've got rather different sized bottoms. And then there's a quote along the back which comes from Hilaire Belloc, who says, "I am a sundial and I make a botch of what is done far better by a watch." Because there's endless arguments about what the time is and what the angle is and stuff like that.
Changing it for British summertime.
Exactly. No, you have to add that on yourself. You have to make allowances.
Yeah. I like the idea of leaving your imprint with posteria for posterity, something along
very
those
good.
Lines.
No, very good.
stunning place to have gardens. I mean, the, you know, the views surrounding them are just extraordinary.
Well, thanks to Joanna McPherson.
But, you know, where we are passing at the moment in Lough Cadam, there's a flock of something just passing low over the water, so it's reflected the water along with the hills. And this, well, I say hills, the mountains. I mean, it's really dramatic there.
That's obviously the sunny side, because this side of the loch, there's very, very few buildings, habitation, that side. All the way along, there are buildings, there's loads of yachts. I've been guilty of not really taking on board that Lough Carron was a sea loch and gave access to Skye. I always thought the line always went, but that wasn't the case.
No, once upon a time, the terminus, the line actually stopped at Strome Ferry. Again, very interesting history behind it. We've arranged to meet up with a guy called Neilleach McCrae. We're about 20 yards away from the station platform. I'm standing on a jetty. The water below us is as clear as gin. You can see right the way down the rock and onto the shingle, mussel shells, everything else. Across the other side of the loch, the sun's shining on the hillside. There's still a band of cloud over the hills. Just beautiful. Yet another stunning location on the west coast.
And the sun's just crept over the top of the hills. There's warmth in it. And you, how many times can you see it? It's painfully beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's times like this you want to just hug yourself. What a fantastic country.
Yeah.
Do we want to share it with the rest of the world? You
Absolutely
want to keep it
not.
To yourself?
No, keep it to myself.
Difficult one.
This is Strome Ferry, Neilleach McCrae. If you come here by car, there's a sign at the top of the road. I've seen it umpteen times. It says Strome Ferry, and then in tiny wee writing beside it, no ferry. What's the story behind that?
In years gone by, this was the main road to the north of Scotland, single-track road. People would come down here, queue for the ferry, which left from this jetty across, what's that, half a mile across the water to North Strome. Two six-car ferries, which would go back and forth all the time. There's one of the ferries similar, well, identical, in fact, that this is the Glenelg route at the moment. So in the early 70s, the road was built around the loch, and in fact, the day the road opened, the ferry shut down. And Strome Ferry, of course, is a big name on the map, although it's a very small hamlet. People expect it to be something significant. It's not particularly now, although it was big time in the past. So the Strome Ferry, no ferry, was put up, and quite an iconic sign.
What is the purpose of writing no ferry, you know, with little letters, besides Strome Ferry in big letters?
Well, as I say, Strome Ferry implies there's a ferry there, and of course there's not now. So to save people being confused, I think it was the only
So the idea is you still get people coming down here looking for a ferry which doesn't exist.
But it always used to make you laugh when you went past it. Make me laugh anyway. Strome Ferry, no ferry. But it was much bigger. It used to be.
Aye, it was. Well, unfortunately, the council in their wisdom decided to take it down. And a few people, myself included, complained about that sort of thing because it was iconic. You know, it appeared in all these TV programmes and in little articles and papers all over the world, so it became iconic and certainly encouraged lots of people to come here, looking for the ferry that wasn't there.
You've not got a wee bit nighttime gorilla sign painting?
Well, I've got an idea where the old sign has gone, so maybe we'll think someday of replacing it, because the one at the moment is not quite so prominent as the old one was. The old one was, as I say, iconic, and you can't replace it with a new one.
Once upon a time, this was the terminus of the railway line. This was as far as it went.
It was, yep. The end of the 1800s, I don't know the exact dates, but very significant strategic area here because all the steamers that went to the islands left from Strome Ferry. The station, they say, was a big glass-covered, quite an elaborate building, and until Kyle came to prominence, Strome Ferry was basically the main stop-off to the Western Isles and the West Coast, and also a port where they took all the herring. The herring came by boat to Strome Ferry and out by train.
It must have been heaving here, folk.
I don't know that it was heaving. I think there are as many houses now as there were before.
But a lot of through traffic, you know, folk trying to get to other places.
Yeah, there must have been. So initially the ferry was actually a big rowing boat. And there are some photographs you'll see quite readily available of the little rowing boat coming in with planks across, taking one boat, quite precarious really. But so it was a busy spot for all these things, and particularly for the fishing. I'm sure you've heard of the riot, the Strome Ferry riot.
Inverness Courier, June the 5th, 1883. A riot of a most extraordinary character occurred at Strome Ferry on Sunday. At 12 o'clock on Saturday night, two steamers arrived at Strome from Stornoway with 7,000 boxes of herring. In accordance with custom and contract, the railway company had their machine in readiness to unload the ships and to dispatch the fish by a special train. But on the arrival of the steamers, there came in boats from Plockton and the Lochal shores, a crowd of 200 men armed with sticks, and stopped the work of discharging. They declared they would permit no Sabbath breaking, and under threats of personal violence, they cleared the pier and possessed themselves of machinery and plant.
A lot of them dressed in women's clothes, all of them carrying cudgels, stopping the train from moving. They called the police, I don't know how, in 1883, but the chief constable got the word. He whistled up a train from Inverness, packed up his seven constables, and off they went to deal with these 200.
Six policemen brought from Dingwall by special train were powerless. They too were driven back, and in the fight, several on both sides were injured. From 12 o'clock on Saturday night to 12 on Sunday night, the crowd kept possession of the railway company's property. During Sunday afternoon, religious services were conducted on the pier.
And what happened was the locals came down, created havoc, and then when the police arrived, of course, they all disappeared into the hills pretty cleverly. Although some of the ringleaders were caught and jailed for a short while.
Came back to Dingwall, wrote to the Home Secretary about it, primarily to say, we're looking after it, we the police are fine, we don't need any soldiers.
Yeah.
Warning them that this is going to happen next week. And it did happen next week, although not quite so severely. Eventually, though, it died down, and the fish could come to market all week.
The occurrence is all the more remarkable that the fish would have been discharged and dispatched from Strone long before church hours, probably between 12:30 and 6 o'clock on Sunday morning, before the people there, generally speaking, are out of their beds.
Just passing through what was probably the reason why the line stopped at Strone Ferry until 1897, when the final leg of the line was completed to Kyle. And it's this stone, Torridonian sandstone. It was a huge challenge to the Victorian engineers.
Yeah, basically had to carve a line all the way out of that rock face. So it must have been a massive, massive undertaking.
But if you look up the loch, you know, towards the mountains, etc., there is a distinct pinkish blush. I mean, I referred to it earlier on the hills, but if you actually just look at the raw stone itself, there's a definite pink blush to that.
It looks like a Native American Indian chief lying on his back. You can see the nose breaking the skyline.
Yeah.
We are now approaching Duncraig. This is a request stop.
It's not just a request stop, it is a B-listed request stop, and I'm not sure what difference that makes.
It's also a private stop.
Alexander Matheson built this place, Duncraig Castle. One of the fruits of the vast fortune that Jardine Matheson made in the Far East from the opium trade. It became a naval hospital during World War II. I think it was a girls' school for a while. It's been renovated and turned into a luxury hotel now. But I mean, looking at the view from there, you can understand why.
Well, there's a private station. There's a wee tiny hexagonal wooden building on one side.
It's like a wee statutory.
And on the other side, I don't know, you're going to see it from here, but you lean over. That is the ultimate hut.
It's very Scandinavian.
Stone built. Big plate glass, looking out onto what is the perfect island to own. Well, some Scots pine.
Again, another one of these little rocky islands with Scots pine on top of it. After that, you've got yachts moored up, and after that, you've got Plockton. You know, and the whole thing is framed, looking through the branches of the Scots pine and the rhododendron. And look down at the water. There's a forest there of bladder wrack, and the water is so clear, you can see right away from the top down to the roots.
See the mountains of Skye, you see the Coolins, and you've got Plockton in this crescent round this lot of really white houses sparkling in the sunshine. It's a real gem on the west coast of Scotland.
Grey heron sitting there at the end of the rock. I mean, I know it sounds like we are gushing. We are gushing for a reason. This has got to be one of the most beautiful railway lines anywhere in the world.
This is seriously bonny. If you imagine, just a sweeping bay round, and there's a stone wall and a shingled beach behind it. The water's more or less flat calm. You're looking out onto hills, dark hills, and there's great ropes of cloud coming off the tops and just hanging there, so you can see the bottom part of the hill, or the bottom third, and the top third, but not the middle third. And just the sound of herring gulls and robins and everything, it's just lovely. Come down to the end of the jetty now, and we're speaking quietly because it is so quiet here, it's really peaceful. And Sulavor is just coming in.
Our transport has arrived.
And again, just motoring in gently to the jetty, and the slightest of ripples at the front. See Callum Skipper in the wheelhouse.
Hello, Callum.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Hello. Hello, I'm Mark. How are
Hi,
you?
Hi, Mark.
Nice to meet you.
That's impressive. You just tied one rope on and brought it that home.
Yeah.
Welcome on board. It's always been a busy village, Plockton. 20 years ago, we had the Hamish Macbeth filming here, so that I wish I had a bigger boat after the Hamish Macbeth programme, because the number of people that came, especially with the wee wasties, the wee jokes. We're still getting people from Hamish Macbeth.
And the Wicker Man, of course.
You want to go over the spot where the Wicker Man, the pen landed?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, okay, Sergeant Howie.
Hey! There. No one but me, my dear.
So there's one of the fishing boats going out to Prawns, Langoustine.
It's a great way to start a day. I mean, it's obviously the way you start every day, but getting out in a boat on a beautiful morning like this is just brilliant.
Yeah, and it's very atmospheric today, look at that.
Yeah.
Little cloud.
So what are you taking folk out to see mainly? Is it just the scenery, is it wildlife?
Seals. There are three seals we know the names of, who are very friendly with us. They make a regular appearance. Ron, Imba and Lou. They're always kind of around.
Okay.
Ron Seal.
Ron.
Imba Seal. And Lou Seal. People come back year after year to see them. Where the seaplane landed, anyway, right here.
Uh-huh.
They passed a photograph around all the men in that stone jetty over there. And if these men, they were all local men, if they knew what the film was about, I don't think they would have had anything to do with it.
No.
Yeah. A couple of them got shocked when they went to the cinema to watch the film.
If you were seeing that for the first time, well, there's no point in explaining the film. If you don't know about it, go and watch it. But it's one of
these merrily satanic pieces, you know, in quite a religious area, so it probably didn't go down terribly well.
The midday sun at midnight.
Look, there's another place that's busy. Is the road to Uppercross, to Bialach.
Oh, yeah.
That high is one over there. You can see cars when they're on it. It's a bit early in the day for cars, but NC500, you've heard of that? Yeah,
you've probably done it. We took a wee electric car round it.
Did you? Now, the other place that's ahead of us is right beyond where the trees come to the sharp point is Kisharm, where we used to build Oryx. I was working there in 1976, building the Ninian Central.
Uh-huh. You were a Kisharm commando, were you?
I was, yeah.
Rare the Kish.
Commandos. Yep.
And
it's a great song.
We've never had a bus.
But we'll build the biggest Oryx you've ever come across. Remember, we're the Kishar Commandos. Anyway, fantastic song. Gabberlunzy. I've actually sung it with the Gabberlunzy.
Have you?
Yeah.
I worked in the Ninian Central.
Did you? Out in the water?
Aye.
Did you? You can actually even see Skye, look.
Oh, there you go.
Beyond Plockton, behind the last house in Plockton. The Coolin, there's plenty of days you can't see Skye. You can even be in Skye and not see it. The name of my boat, Sulevore, is a big gannet. Uh-huh. Now, we do get the occasional gannets. There weren't many this year, but there are, we do get gannets occasionally.
Sea eagles here as well?
Yes. There's a pair of sea eagles nesting over in the rear where the trees come to the point there.
Right.
Yeah. Every time my brother-in-law has a few drinks, he tells me that he was the captain of the Nimrod that took the first sea eagles from Norway to Scotland. On my phone, I've got a photograph of the crew of the Nimrod with four cardboard boxes.
Aye.
Standing on the steps of the Nimrod. And inside these boxes are the first sea eagles. So he tells me he was the guy that introduced them, took them back.
So many islands, though. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Littered.
There's a lighthouse on this island.
Skye again.
The lighthouse is built for the railway, because the railway line used to stop at Stone Ferry when it was built originally. And when it stopped there, that was the end of the line. The fishing boats, passenger boats, and now the Hebrides sailed up the loch. So there's a lighthouse. There's navigation marks in the middle of the water there. See this white one ahead of us? Over there, white one, there's a red one behind us. They're only 3 years old. The old navigation mark is now in my garden. So pride of place in my garden.
You mentioned the railway then. Do people actually come and do the tourist thing by train still?
Yes, yeah. Just a couple of days ago, we had a big hen party from Dingwall. So, Dingwall. Especially at the weekends.
Give me a sense of the geography. You were saying the Gardnabar over there, Loch Kishon, but, you know,
That sharp top mountain away in the distance. Right. Beyond Kishon is Ben Alligan.
Okay.
Torridon.
Right.
The Coolin, of course. Well, Coolin's a cloud. Behind the lighthouse, left-hand side of the lighthouse.
Okay.
The Bialachnabar, almost ahead of us.
And we're in Loch Carron at the moment.
Loch Carron, yeah. If we were to go further out the loch as well, on a clear day, we would see Askerville on the Island of Rum behind Skye. Mm-hmm. So that's 60 miles away, Askerville.
How long have you been doing this?
38 years.
It's kind of a cliched question, but it must inevitably get to be a bit, oh, it's another day, it's another seal.
No, it's different. Every day is different, every trip is different, people are different. I'm a nervous wreck first thing in the morning because I don't know if the seals are going to be there. Can't sleep at night time for worrying. But no, I enjoy it.
You don't strike me as being the nervous type, Carl, I have to say.
Carl McKenzie there, and we're back in the station at Plockton, and it's a lovely wee old-fashioned Victorian station building. It's painted English Racing green and a sort of cream colour. But another challenge this line occurred in the 20th century when it very nearly shut down altogether. Here's David Spavin.
In the 1950s, with the rise of incomes, the growth of car ownership, many people started abandoning the railway, particularly in rural areas. Ultimately, that led to the government panicking about the losses that British Railways started making in the late 1950s. The government then were alarmed and they appointed Dr. Beeching, who came from the chemicals giant ICI, with a remit to turn the railways into a profitable operation. And that's, of course, where we had the infamous Beeching Report in 1963, which proposed all the routes north of Inverness for closure.
There's never been a doomsday book of British Railways like this. Remote areas of the Highlands will lose their services.
Isn't there something to be said for the railways being run as a service to the nation rather than on the strict profit and loss basis of a private company?
There is something to be said, but I think it's a doubtful argument. Somebody's got to pay, and if a service of this kind is not supported by those who use it, then it means a tax on the populace in general.
The Highlanders put up an amazing fight, and it was really a test case example of how to campaign against closure of a railway. The press got involved, politicians, local authorities, farmers, industrialists, businessmen, the public, everybody. They called themselves the Highland Vigilantes, but they used a slogan called McPuff.
Fight, fight, fight this every way. Macbeth fights the common foe. Dr. Beechin, he must go, but the railways never know, for Macbeth is riding on a railway train.
In the country areas, it's doubtful whether the railways carry as much as 10% of the traffic that there is. Nearly all the rail services which we intend to cut out run parallel with bus services. And even where they don't, it's very much cheaper to run a bus instead of the railway.
He says they've got no money for the railways, and the best that he can do is close them down. Weigh our money, fay whiskey, we could run the railways free, and hey, umpteen branch lines running to Aitchton.
By the time the proposal for closure had been on the stocks since the Beeching report through to 1964, it became quite apparent to the then Conservative government that there was no way these railways could close, A, because the alternatives by road, particularly on the bus, were very, very inadequate, and also because the railway was a key agent of regional economic development. Developments like, ultimately, the aluminium smelter at Invergordon, the big grain distillery at Invergordon, the nuclear establishment at Dounreay, they all went there partly because there was a railway to service them. So in the end, the Conservative government had no alternative but to say, we cannot close these routes. Some smaller stations were closed, but the route survived, and really it's the most remarkable survivor out of the entire Beeching report.
Fight, fight, fight to save a railway. Macbeth fights the common foe. Dr. Beechin, he must go, but the railways never know, for Macbeth is riding on the railway train.
I wonder if we're just being spoiled by the weather.
It's like this all the time. Never rains across here, there's no midges.
Presumably you get a completely different experience when it's moody and dark.
Yeah. It is combination of the clarity of the water, the fact that the rocks are sort of this greyish, pinkish colour, you've got, you know, that bright chrome yellow, whatever it is that grows on the rocks when you've got salt water attached to it. You know, that, I can't remember, what do they call it again? Is that crottle?
It's a nice word.
Yeah, well, it's C-R-O-T-A-L, and it was used as a dye stuff. It actually produces a green dye rather than
lichen.
Yellow.
Lichen.
It's a type of lichen, I think. But
you can almost bore yourself stupid saying how terrific this is. Because we have been accused in the past of overhyping it, which I would defend to the hilt. We've never overhyped anything.
Never knowingly overhyped.
There is just so much brilliant stuff to see. There's a yacht just coming down from the Coolins. It's a high speed rib going out to pass it.
Something out in the water there splashing. Look.
Oh, see? Dolphins.
I don't know if it was dolphins or whales.
Oh, not cutting! No! Stop it! This is nonsense!
For love of goodness, get in the road!
There's scenery to be done. Anyway, there was a lot of thrashing in the water.
Aye.
It could have been seals playing with salmon, I suppose.
Could have all, whatever it was actually coming out of the water.
Come on!
Here we go. Right. Can't see anything now, unless it's dead.
Please
stop for the service. We'll be carried for Welsh for this train will terminate. Please cycle passengers who use Nisgott Air Service. Any passengers want to come back with us this afternoon, then our trains at 5 past 12 quarter to 2 and 10 past 5.
That's 5 past 12 quarter to 2 and 10 past 5 for your return journey. Oh, fine, sunny day. Lovely. Then somewhere around about Hennigan, friends of the Kyle Line, the museum. But before that, there's something magical about stealing down the station surrounded by boats, looking across the sky.
My name is Mary Jane Campbell, and I'm standing in the museum of the Friends of the Kyle Line shop on the station at Kyle O'Halt.
We've lost McElwraith completely because there's a model railway off to his left, essentially.
There's a huge model railway over the pier at Plockton. You've got some lovely carriages, lovely trains. It's surrounded by railway memorabilia.
This is, I mean, this is lovely. It's great fun and it's interesting, but what's the purpose of it? Why did you set it up?
It started out off in the 1970s when the railway was being threatened with closure, and a relation of my own, Torquil Nicholson, who was the councillor at the time, decided to get a group together to fight the railway being closed, and that's where it started from. But it's continued because these lines are always under threat. At the moment, it looks very busy, but sometimes in the winter it can be quite quiet, and I don't know how much profit they make. It's all about profit, really.
Well, you see, and that's interesting, because we were talking earlier about the fact, I mean, this is a spectacular section of railway line. I mean, the scenery's stunning. It's very comfortable. It's a great way to see, really quite remote parts of Scotland. But it doesn't seem to be being promoted anywhere, and we can't quite understand that.
There have been various steam train trips done, specials like that. But I don't think it's promoted anything like as much as the Fort William to Malleg line, for example. That seems to get a lot more publicity.
We're saying on the way across here, this is a more attractive line. Nothing taking anything away from the Malleg line, which is beautiful, but there are parts of that journey that are incredibly, painfully beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, there are, and I don't know quite why it hasn't been publicised to the same level. Well, as the Friends of the Kyle Line, of course, that's part of our remit, is to try and get it more publicity.
Do you ever hear many people saying, no, you should really close this down?
No, not many people say it, but then an awful lot of people travel by car and don't use the rail, of the local people don't use the railway line perhaps as much as they should.
Amongst us, there was a realisation, goodness me, instead of driving, we should have been getting the train to go to Plockton or go to Achnacheen or wherever. And make much more use of it.
I'm going to have to try not to argue against that.
You don't have to argue against
it. Because the trouble is, if you're going for your big shop to Inverness, it's so much easier to bung it in the boot than carry it around. But, I mean, when I was a child, we always went in the train to Inverness. A big deal, twice a year, family outings to Inverness.
Almost invariably, and I know this is a massive generalisation, railways, it's a bloke thing. Train spotters, the vast majority of them are blokes. The ones that rebuild trains are blokes. The ones that try and set up section line are blokes. So why are you involved in it?
I'm involved just as a local person who wants to make sure that the railway keeps going. I have to say I have no expertise in model railways and things. Although when I was a child, I probably would have thanked you more for a model railway than a doll for Christmas, frankly, but... and when my nephews were small, I rather hoped they'd be given model railways so that I could...
You could play with them.
Show them how to use them.
Everybody should have a model railway.
Yes.
You look like you've got an honest face. So, I'm sure you'll give me an honest answer on this. We were sitting watching folk on the train, and I'm assuming they were local because they were sitting reading the books. They weren't looking out the window at all. If you take the train nowadays, do you stop seeing the view?
No, you don't stop seeing the view. But I might read a book as well. I mean, it is quite a long journey. People say that because I live in Plockton, the most beautiful village in the entire route, and my house looks out on probably the most painted view in Scotland. And people say, do you still see it? And yes, of course I still see it in the morning. You wake up in the morning and it's just dawn and it's beautiful. And of course you still see it. And it's good for the soul to be looking at beautiful scenery.
There's something magnificent about having a train that comes right down into the harbour and is surrounded by boats and water and fantastic scenery. The sun is still shining. That boat that we saw earlier on when we were going past Plockton is now sailing down past us.
That's the Gordonston School's yacht cruising majestically down to the waters of Skye. It is wonderful.
And from here, the Skye Bridge is just this single, very graceful arch. And behind that, there's the Coolin standing out in sunshine. Everything's just white and clean and blue. The whole trip has been fantastic.
Teeming with fish.
Aye.
Even when you come out of the train, it's been tinged with sadness, you feel the spirit soar. Aye. Here you are, the gateway. Yeah. We've had a fantastic time getting here, but there are so many joys that await you from this very point.
It started off in Inverness, quite misty, and then a bit like the Dance of the Seven Veils, and they kind of drifted off, and everything's been a series of reveals, and it's got more and more dramatic. And here we are, what was the gateway to the Isles. I mean, this was a communication hub that took people all over the West Coast from here. For the money that it costs, which isn't very much, I cannot recommend this train trip enough. It's really outstanding. Beautiful, beautiful scenery.
Yep.
Only one thing left to do. It's go to the Dancing in Kyle.
Go to the Dancing in Kyle. From all of the team, do see Aberdeen out of doors. Thanks for listening.